You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next on the Jefferson Exchange, Morgan Ackley will host a series of short news features from around our region.
I'm Morgan Ackley, and for decades, companies have wanted to restart mining nickel in Southern Oregon. As JPR's Justin Higginbottom reports, a changing market and pro-mining administration might finally bring the industry back to the state.
Homeland Nickel CEO Steve Balch is driving with a team of geologists and business partners up winding roads within the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest.
We are in the largest ultramafic rock complex in North America. It's called the Josephine Ophiolite.
What makes this stretch of geology special is that the soil has low amounts of silica and can carry high amounts of metals, like nickel, which is what brings Balch here today. Homeland Nickel has a mining claim nearby.
So this is laterite. What you're seeing here is 1% nickel.
Road cuts reveal laterite, this reddish soil high in iron. It's what gives the 2,000-acre mining claim nearby its name, Red Flat. Robert Osborne is a geologist who specializes in nickel laterite. He likes what he sees.
You take that and you take it in your hands. It's crumbly.
He takes out a magnet and waves it over the red soil in his hand. It sticks. That means there's iron in this laterite. It's a good sign there's nickel below. Balch estimates Red Flat has over 300 million pounds of the metal. That's only one of nine claims Homeland Nickel has in Southern Oregon. Balch thinks a nearby site named Cleopatra holds over 700 million pounds of nickel.
By tons, our Cleopatra deposit is the single largest nickel deposit in the United States.
That's besides a large low-grade deposit in Alaska. So if there's so much nickel in Southern Oregon, why hasn't it been mined? One reason is that there's been enough on the global market. Right now, most nickel comes from Chinese-run mines in Indonesia.
Calling Indonesia the Saudi Arabia of nickel is actually an insult to Indonesia because its market share is vastly larger than that of Saudi Arabia with respect to oil.
That's Colin Hendricks with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says demand could soon outpace supply. Historically, nickel was mostly used in stainless steel products, but future demand is expected to come from electric vehicle batteries. The International Energy Agency says nickel demand will nearly double by 2040. The only current U.S. nickel mine is in Michigan and slated to close in 2030.
I think that the real unknowns are what kind of policies the U.S. puts in place to support not just the domestic nickel industry, but also many of the other kind of critical mineral supply chains and industries.
The largest nickel mine in U.S. history was in Douglas County. The Riddle Mine operated for decades with crucial support from the federal government. After the mine closed in 1998, neighbors complained of lingering health concerns over exposure to air pollution. Michael Dotson is with the conservation group Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center. He says plans for nickel mining in Southern Oregon and pushback from environmental groups is nothing new.
Concerned communities back in the 80s and early 90s seeing the nickel mining as a threat to their watersheds, that was a big impetus to organize and secure protections for Northwest California's Smith River National Recreation Area.
Those concerned communities helped put a 20-year ban on new mining claims on over 100,000 acres of federal land in southwestern Oregon. But historic claims like Homeland Nickel's Red Flat area can move forward with a Forest Service permit. Dotson says that would be devastating for the pristine environment.
We're talking about a form of probably strip mining in order to find small traces of the mineral.
Balch with Homeland Nickel understands why people oppose mining in the area.
The mining industry has treated the environment like crap. I don't think anyone disputes that.
But he says byproducts left after removing nickel from this laterite are non-toxic, and his company is required to restore native vegetation after mining. While there remains distrust from those concerned about the environment, his company may have a friend in the White House. President Trump has directed agencies to speed up the permitting process. Balch says it used to take over a year for the Forest Service to even respond to a permit request.
Since the Trump administration has become involved indirectly with our file, we're getting very timely response from the Forest Service kind of on a weekly basis.
Despite concerns over the environment, the current administration and growing market might bring nickel back to Oregon for the first time in 20 years. Justin Higginbottom, JPR News.
Instead of watching fireworks to commemorate America's 250th birthday, over the 4th of July weekend, about 400 people went on a pilgrimage to the site of a former camp where Japanese Americans were imprisoned during World War II. GPR's Roman Battalius shares their story.
Buddhist priest Duncan Williams recites a prayer meant to alleviate suffering caused by the hatred and ignorance of others. Behind him is a small concrete jail, one of the few structures left at the Tule Lake Segregation Center. Williams and 400 others are here for a memorial service to remember the 331 people who died at this camp between 1942 and 1946. Williams has everyone collectively recite their names to ensure they aren't forgotten.
Baby boy Yamamuro.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, over 100,000 Japanese Americans were imprisoned in one of 10 so-called relocation centers across the country. Tule Lake sits on open rangeland 8 miles south of the Oregon border. It was known for having some of the harshest conditions. Everyone who came on this biannual pilgrimage is here for their own reason. Phyllis Iwasaki has a direct connection with Tule Lake.
I want to pay tribute to my family, my grandparents, my parents, older brother, who was just a toddler at the time, and my sister, who was born in Newell at the camp.
Hiroshi Shimizu is the president of the Tule Lake Committee, which organizes the pilgrimages. He told the crowd that the U.S. Constitution should have prevented this.
Yet during World War II, those constitutional guarantees were abandoned by men in power who chose fear over principle.
Shimizu says the goal of the pilgrimages is to remember what happened at this camp and honor those who died there. He got involved because of his own connection to Tule Lake.
I arrived in Tule Lake at 6 months old in September of 1943. I was born in March and went on what I call the grand tour of incarceration sites.
Shimizu is not the only camp survivor on the pilgrimage. Satsuki Ina was born in this camp. She says she knows firsthand the brutality that faced those who protested the camps. Her father was charged with sedition and taken from his family for speaking out.
He was held here for several days, and the mugshot that I found of him from his FBI files shows that he had been beaten. He had bruises and contusions all over his face.
Ina is one of the co-founders of Sudu for Solidarity, an activist group. The camps are often referred to as internment camps, but Ina says that's not accurate, as internment is a legal term describing the imprisonment of enemy nationals. Most people in the camps were American citizens. Ina says what happened here fits the definition of a concentration camp.
The euphemistic language was used to suppress the truth, to minimize what they actually did. So, we're working fervently, really, to correct the language.
She says it's hard to see what's happening today at ICE detention facilities and not see the similarities to her own experience.
We feel like because of what happened to us, it's really important for us to show up in ways that people didn't show up for us back in 1942.
Chizu Omori, another camp survivor, is worried about the singling out of people based on their race or ethnicity.
We're going backwards, and that's a hard thing to accept because do we learn our lessons? Apparently not.
That's why this pilgrimage feels more poignant than ever. After the memorial ceremony, most of the pilgrims gather with signs and banners to directly connect the historical events of Japanese-American incarceration with modern-day immigration enforcement.
The greatest risk of all is to do nothing.
We must all choose to act now.
For the sake of our ancestors, for the sake of our families, for the sake of our children.
Pro domo tamani, there are children, set them free.
Roman Battaglia, JPR News.
There are children, set them free.
For years, the town of Lakeview in southern Oregon has had its problems with water. It comes out of the tap looking brown and contains potentially dangerous chemicals, and the town government has been unable to fix the problem. As Joni Audreland reports, some residents have taken matters into their own hands.
Walking into the Sheer Experience Salon in Lakeview, the first thing that hits you is the smell of sulfur, like rotten eggs. Stacy Phillips, a stylist at the salon, says the stench is hard to miss.
Here, where we're washing people's hair every single day, the odor is crazy. It's pretty potent once you turn the water on here.
This is an everyday reality for many in Lakeview. It's not just the smell. Water here comes out of the tap discolored, sometimes as brown as a cup of coffee. It's been a problem for years, and it impacts every decision in this town, from which house you buy to when you do your laundry. most people get their drinking water shipped to their homes in large jugs. For businesses like this salon, it can be financially damaging.
Especially when people come here for like a beauty day, you know, you want to feel pampered and you want to feel like it's great, and then you have this horrible odor. It's not. It's kind of a deterrent.
The reasons why the water is so dirty are complex. First, most of it comes from ground wells, which are rich in manganese and iron. They give the water that brownish red color. Second, underneath the town are miles of deteriorating pipes that haven't been replaced in decades. Some of that leaches into the water, making it dirtier and potentially unsafe to use. Recent tests show the water in Lakeview has levels of lead beyond federal limits.
Pretty much no client's hair is unscathed from the water.
Another stylist, Sunny Rigg, started cutting hair in Lakeview 4 years ago. She noticed some clients had damaged, brittle hair. At first, she thought they had some underlying health problems.
And then it became obvious that it was everyone I was seeing. And then I experienced it for myself.
She now washes her own hair in her kitchen sink, using water from a filter, hoping it'll grow back. Normally, the town government would fix these problems, but Lakeview is struggling to stay afloat, and much of the water infrastructure has fallen through the cracks. Interim town manager Stan Foster says the town failed to perform required water tests for years. It also failed to complete a mandatory survey of all lead pipes in its system. Foster says the situation needs to be fixed, or Lakeview runs the risk of becoming another city with widespread water issues, like Flint, Michigan.
Our water is right on the edge of the clean water standards. We don't want Lakeview to be the Flint of the West.
Like many timber towns, Lakeview also has a lacking economy. Some people here worry that if the town's water doesn't improve, it can never truly move forward. Landon Dibdle is the CEO of Lake County's only hospital. He says the town's reputation for bad water has implications beyond public health. For a region trying to rebound, it continues to be an obstacle.
People that are thinking about moving to town and then they experience that water or read about it, that puts us a lot further down on the list. We had another candidate that brought it up and actually pulled out of the running because of that.
The town is close to opening a new water treatment plant, which they hope will fix some of the manganese and iron issues. But until the pipes are fixed, it's unclear how effective that will really be. And some residents have gotten tired of waiting.
We're gonna go right up that, on top of that mountain, in the back.
Scott Stewart is driving into the Warner Mountains overlooking Lakeview, the town he's lived in most of his life. It's a winding dirt road littered with potholes and fallen trees.
You can see some of the trees that we've had to push out of the way and cut out.
He's driving to an abandoned natural spring owned by the town of Lakeview. It used to provide the town with a cleaner source of water. For reasons unknown, it was essentially left to rot.
I even seen the fence down, although this wire was all on the ground. Water was coming up everywhere. This was just flooded. It's like, what the hell is going on?
He soon realized his beleaguered town government couldn't repair the spring. So last summer, he and a group of friends decided to fix it on their own. At the site several months later, you could still see evidence of their work. Piles of rusty crumbled pipes next to gigantic tree roots.
And some of the pipes were shifted and collapsed, and others were just plumb full of roots.
Stewart has had 13 back surgeries and needs a hiking stick to get through this mud. It was strenuous and difficult work over several months for his crew, largely using their own money and tools.
We came up here first thing in the spring when the mosquitoes were so thick, and then in the hot part of the summer, we were up here working all June, July, August, September.
They ended up laying 300 feet of new pipe. He hopes this can be a big win for the town he loves. Like many people here, he feels the government is not going to come in and help.
It's just frustrating as hell to see our town, you know, just kind of dwindle away.
The town hopes to have the spring running in the next couple of months. Stewart, who recently had his hip replaced, still says he would volunteer again to get this project over the finish line. I'm Joni Odd and Land reporting.